This download is made possible by all the generous folks who support public radio. If that includes you, thank you. If not, become a contributing member to your local station. And now, here's the show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, starring in the radio play of my own life. Oh, that's what you get to dream every day on the air. But anyone can play this game. And with the Richard Linklater film Boyhood coming out this weekend, it follows one child coming of age over 12 years. Anyone can indeed play. Hey, take a story from your own life and make it a movie pitch for us. We can help you. The number is 877-8-MY-TAKE, and we'll cast you in a little trailer at least. We're going to have some fun this hour. We will examine the Shakespearean tragedy of the Brazilian soccer loss to Germany this week at the World Cup.
I have no words. My voice is in my blade. Thou bloody a villain, and terms can give thee out!
And there's a spy thriller brewing between Germany and the United States, or is it a Marx Brothers comedy?
This is a fact we can't ignore.
It is a real live espionage case that has sent Germany into an uproar after U.S. officials refused to cooperate with German inquiries into our intelligence activities. The German government announced its plans to begin spying on the U.S. for the first time since 1945. But we turn now to the ongoing humanitarian crisis taking place along our southern border. As thousands of child migrants make their way across the U.S. border from Central America, President Obama visited Texas Governor Rick Perry on Wednesday to discuss Obama's proposal for additional funding from Congress to address the situation. But congressional Republicans are calling for more than just money.
The number one message to stop this is planes arriving in Honduras and Guatemala with these children back home. That sends the message.
And Thursday, the United Nations announced what might be a change in messaging. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees wants the United States and Mexico to recognize the children as refugees, saying that those from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras should not be forced to return home where they will be subject to persecution. A lot of you think there's a limit to what the U.S. can do.
So many here say, don't take. Well, I think the people that are just saying don't take are not looking worldwide as to what America looks like when we say that.
On our Facebook page, Maria calls on her fellow citizens to find a little compassion. It bothers me that these distinctions matter so much. The implication is that they deserve sympathy if they are refugees, but not if they are just illegal immigrants. But they are clearly refugees. No one wants to send children out in the world like that unless there's a compelling reason. What is the distinction between being a refugee and being an immigrant? And what do these terms mean, both legally and politically, for the young kids crossing the border? For answers, we turn now to David Simmons, adjunct professor of law at the University of Denver, and Jana Mason, senior advisor for external affairs for the United Nations Refugee Agency. Mason says it's all about selecting which cases are obvious refugees and which are not.
We think that some percentage, still unknown, but some percentage of these individuals, these children, could be refugees, could be fleeing the grounds that would give rise to a refugee claim. We do recognize this is a complex migration phenomenon. It's what we call a mixed migration situation. People are fleeing this region for a whole host of reasons. Some of them, of course, just because of the absolute abject poverty that's going on down in that region. Some of them, unfortunately, children are being trafficked because of the growing influence of trafficking networks. Some of them may have the desire to join family in other countries. And some of them, quite a number of them we know from interviews, are fleeing violence. Some kids we talked to said they could barely get from one end of town to the other without experiencing some sort of violent episode. So in cases where individuals are fleeing violence and there's some element of it that is tied to persecution, but some of these individuals may meet the refugee definition. We don't know how many that would be. That would be up to U.S. government adjudicators to determine. What we're asking for is that they be given a chance to tell their story so that someone can make that decision.
And your interest is purely in the motivations and the circumstances of their departure from the country and your concern with the political stalemates in the United States and the way in which we view migrants in the United States is immaterial. And that would be normal in your case, right, Jana?
Yeah, I think what we're trying to do is change the narrative a little bit. I mean, it's unfortunate that this whole thing, because of the timing, because of the politics, has gotten caught up in the broader immigration reform debate. Obviously, that's an important debate to have, but all the focus is on the extent to which this is tied in with U.S. immigration policies. And we don't think there's been quite enough focus on what is it that's compelling these kids to leave, regardless of where they decide to go, regardless of how they get there. What is it that's driving them even from their homes? Because most people don't leave their homes for no reason. So we're hoping that everyone can look a little bit deeply into the source of the violence, the nature of what's going down there, so that we can make the case that these children, if they need it, should have access to a process to determine if they're entitled to refugee protection. If they're not, if they don't meet that definition, we fully understand, then they're subject to normal U.S. deportation or removal procedures.
All right, David Simmons stipulating now, and you're an adjunct professor of law at the University of Denver, stipulating for the moment that the motivations that might qualify these individuals as refugees under U.N. definitions might differ under the definitions in the United States. How do you see the legal distinction between refugee status and any other status that the U.S. government might be considering here?
Well, the United States government has, since 1980, recognized the international definition of a refugee, both in the way that we designate people to come to the United States as refugees and the way we treat people who are already in the United States who are allowed to apply for political asylum. The factors are very similar. We're looking at whether or not these individuals, these children in this case, are suffering persecution for the grounds that Ms. Mason was discussing. And then we have a process in the United States through either the Department of Homeland Security or the Department of Justice to evaluate those cases.
Do you think that the U.S. government is trying to speak out of both sides of their mouth here regarding the definition of refugee status here? Certainly there have been special cases in U.S. law down through history, the way we treat Cubans, the way we might treat people from other countries, whether they're refugees or whether they are designated as, you know, economic migrants.
Absolutely. The executive branch does have the ability to designate groups of individuals as refugees. And as you noted, that has been done in the past. It could be done in a case like this. But typically a refugee designation applies to individuals who are outside of the United States. Once they get to the United States, the mechanism is to apply for political asylum. We definitely have a humanitarian crisis, and my fear as an immigration attorney and as a law professor is that we're looking at something similar to what happened before the Second World War with the SS St. Louis, where a group of individuals fled Nazi Germany and tried to get to a safe haven in the United States. There was no mechanism to really let them into the United States. They ended up going back to the Netherlands, and most of them were captured by the Nazis when they invaded the Netherlands and subsequently killed in concentration camps. Obviously, this isn't quite that situation, but we have a compelling humanitarian crisis. So we have a government at this point that's not really prepared to adequately address what we do in this situation.
So, whoa, I mean, you are literally comparing this situation here to the kind of bureaucratic sort of holdup that resulted in the deaths of Jews during the Holocaust. Obviously, you made a distinction there, but the same reasons for the holdup would make this situation comparable to what happened on the St. Louis?
Well, I certainly hope that the results aren't the same, but the manifestations of the problem are very similar. We have a bureaucratic system that does not have a mechanism in place to deal with the crisis. The government is taking what actions it deems necessary, but at this point, I don't think anybody's standing back from this situation other than in crisis management mode and looking at either the driving factors that Ms. Mason talked about, or, you know, frankly, how we come across as a culture and how we come across as a society in dealing with this situation.
Jana, I'm frankly tempted to put you on the spot here. Do you agree with what David Simmons is saying, that this is reminiscent of the kind of bureaucratic stalemate that resulted in the deaths of individuals during the Holocaust?
Well, actually, I can get off the spot because the situation is quite different in the way it's playing out. As David explained earlier, there's a process to admit refugees directly from overseas, and then there's the asylum process, which is very individualized in nature. So what's happening now at our borders doesn't require a group designation. All it requires is that once people get to the border, once they enter the U.S., that they're allowed to make an individual determination. And we recognize that the numbers are massive and they're overwhelming the existing ability of the U.S. authorities to deal with them right now. We're very sympathetic to that. But some people are saying, oh, these kids will stay here forever. Well, we know from our experience that the U.S. has, you know, a very well-developed asylum adjudication system, and that when done right, it doesn't have to take forever. It won't take years. It won't take months. It doesn't even have to take, you know, weeks to get at the heart of the matter of why these kids are fleeing. But we know that it can't be done in summary fashion at the border with traumatized children who are still basically shell-shocked from what they've just gone through. You can't take a 7-year-old and say, tell us your story right away. Are you a refugee? So it's going to take a little bit of time. But if there are enough resources devoted to it, they can make these adjudications in a quick enough fashion to decide who needs protection, who needs to stay in the U.S., and who can be returned to their countries.
All right. So, you know, maybe we're making a mountain over a molehill regarding refugee versus immigrant or migrant here. But for both of you, what would reassure you that the U.S. is on a course that would be consistent with the humanitarian principles that matter most to you at the United Nations and that matter most to you as an attorney, David Simmons? Jana, you first.
From the UNHCR, UN Refugee Agency perspective, all that we're looking for is assurances that no child or adults, if they happen to be part of the population, will be immediately or summarily sent back without what we would consider a full and fair chance to tell their story. It doesn't have to drag out for a long time. As long as they interview these children, really look deeply into why they're fleeing, and for those that would fear persecution if returned, that they're given a chance then to be granted asylum.
David Simmons, as an attorney, how confident are you that the U.S. has such a process and that they will use it consistent with the humanitarian norms that would keep us from comparing this, as you did, to the situation during the Holocaust?
I'm somewhat confident. I agree with Ms. Mason. There is an asylum procedure that is in place. It is a procedure that doesn't have to take a tremendous amount of time. What I am concerned about is that what we've seen so far is an insistence on placing these children in any location, regardless of whether they have access to an immigration court, regardless of whether they have access to legal counsel, which, in my opinion, is crucial to any fair adjudication of whether or not an individual qualifies for political asylum. This is not a touchy-feely humanitarian remedy we're talking about. It is a technical legal remedy with 40 years of jurisprudence, sometimes contradictory, behind it. What I'm afraid I'm seeing with this administration is an emphasis on bureaucratic convenience and a lower level of concern for the due process rights of the children.
Jana Mason and David Simmons, thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jana Mason is the Senior Advisor for External Affairs at the United Nations, and David Simmons is Adjunct Professor of Law at the University of Denver. The year-long tension over U.S. electronic spying on diplomats has created tangible strains in the U.S.-German relationship. The German government expelled the chief American intelligence official in Berlin on Thursday in response to the alleged discovery of a ham-handed double agent. The United States has called the move extreme.
The strength of our national security relationship with Germany is important to American national security. It's also important to the national security of the Germans. That's why we have this open dialogue with them on a variety of channels to resolve the situation.
White House spokesman Josh Earnest there on damage control duty. Germany's interior minister announced he would no longer rule out counter-espionage of the U.S. As the relationship between the U.S. and Germany becomes icier, we turn now to Suda David Wilp, senior transatlantic fellow of the German Marshall Fund of the United States. Suda joins us from Berlin. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, John.
Now, does Germany's sense of outrage over all this come with the message, we would never do anything like this, because the U.S. message is everybody does this, and this is sort of par for the course in electronic espionage these days?
I would agree. I'm actually very surprised by the naivete here in Germany. There is a sense of self-righteousness here, too, that I have picked up because you're right. I feel like countries that have national interests realize that spying is an essential tool to protect one's country. And you would think a country like Germany, 25 years after the fall of the wall, realizes that there are significant security challenges for Western democracies and that sometimes there is spying even among allies. But I think the Germans are also a bit miffed that the spying that has occurred has been almost a bit amateurish. The alleged double agent in the German intelligence service was sort of like a mailroom guy. I mean, he was sort of a mid-level person, and he gave documents over to the United States, allegedly, but really those documents had no value. And the Germans are like, why don't you just talk to us and perhaps we can give you that information? There was no need to sort of create a mole in our intelligence service.
Well, if you look at the record over the last few years, you've got Chelsea Manning, acquiring zillions of documents. You've got Ed Snowden over in Russia basically opening a national archive for national security documents. It's not as though the U.S. has much of a track record of maintaining its leak-proof national security apparatus, let alone whatever agents it might be using as double agents in Germany.
Exactly. And I mean, this also shows that the Germans need to beef up their own intelligence, because this also looks really bad on the part of Germany's security apparatus. There are news reports that say that this double agent in the defense ministry, he's probably been working for the Americans since 2010.
So the statement from the interior minister that Germany would no longer rule out counter-espionage of the U.S., are we to take that seriously, that actually there has been no counter-espionage of the U.S., or suddenly now they're going to flick some switch and the U.S. hasn't already figured out how to keep that from supplying information to the Germans?
That's a great question, because the Germans are sort of between a rock and a hard place. They need the United States as a partner for many things, including intelligence sharing. I mean, look, there has been no terrorist attack here in Germany, like there has been in other European cities, like in Madrid and London. And Chancellor Merkel, I think, sleeps better at night knowing that the BND, her intelligence service, works with U.S. intelligence services. And they also realized without the Americans, to build up a apparatus like the United States has would cost enormous amount of money and resources. And so this may be rhetoric right now, but it would take years for the Germans to come up with this so-called 360 degree outlook on intelligence, as the interior minister has commented.
Suda David Wilp is senior transatlantic fellow of the German Marshall Fund of the United States. Thanks so much, Suda.
Thanks, John.
Joining us now is Kai Biermann, who's an editor at the German newspaper Die Zeit Online. Kai, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, welcome. Thanks for having me.
So naive, the Germans are really sort of kind of clueless about how espionage is done these days and a little jealous of the U.S. technology. What do you say to that?
Are we naive, really? Let me refer to some of the events that upset Germans the most, okay? First, you tapped the phone of Chancellor Angela Merkel. Seriously, why? Is she a known terrorist? Is she even a suspect? Is she plotting something? I don't think so. And many Germans think likewise. Merkel's phone was a strong meme here. In the eyes of the NSA, no one is innocent.
But don't you have listening devices in hotel rooms and, high security facilities in Germany just to make sure that you can sort of follow what's going on in diplomatic discussions?
I don't know. I think so. But we don't have such devices on any internet backbone here. I think we have quite a different understanding of surveillance, of state surveillance, than the U.S., maybe.
I guess I'm trying to understand the difference between the principle of we would never do this under any circumstances and the question of having a technological edge, which you did have during World War II, as I recall.
We see government surveillance as necessary just as you do, right? It has to be limited by law, controlled by the parliament and by courts, and then it's okay. But we have a problem with the idea of comprehensive surveillance. We have a problem with the concept that you have to save everything and you have to build a giant haystack to find one needle in there afterwards. And if you have a reasonable suspicion. You can watch the bad guy in every way you want, even in Germany. But you can't watch all the people all the time in the hope to find one bad guy. We have experienced what global surveillance can do to a society. You know, we have seen it in Nazi Germany and with the Stasi in the German Democratic Republic. Surveillance destroys trust and solidarity.
Would you compare the United States to the Stasi in East Germany?
Yeah, in some ways, yeah. The concept of I want to know all from all of you is nearly the same.
Is there any way to repair this relationship? What do you think should be done here?
You are one of our closest allies, right? We think of America as a friend, as a true friend, really. And you liberated us from the Nazis, but I think what we need now is a little more transparency, a little in this partnership, a little more trust. At the moment, when you call a member of the German parliament, one of the first sentences often is, you know that this conversation is tabbed, right? They don't trust their phones anymore. And in our democracy, it's a no-go to wiretap an MP. So trust us. Trust us that we find the bad guys on our own and ask us if you want to know anything about us, but then wiretap our phones.
Kai Biermann is an editor at the German newspaper Die Zeit Online. Kai, thank you so much.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
You know, for a generation now, it's kind of like we've all been in a Richard Linklater movie.
Oh. Look where I'm down in the street.
I know, right? Look at those.
This weekend, Linklater's latest, 12 Years in the Making, Boyhood, opens in theaters. Documentary meets procrastination. The director follows the story of a young boy named Mason. It's a movie that blurs the line between documentary and fiction and really looks at time almost as a character rather than a Back to the Future or a Truman Show special effect.
Good morning! Oh, and in case I don't see you, good afternoon, good evening, and good night.
It's a little like Harry Potter. We got to watch him grow up on screen, right? Meets the Michael Apted Up series, where he explored England's economic landscape by interviewing a group of 7-year-olds.
I'm going to work in Woolworths.
When I grow up, I want to be an astronaut.
When I get married, I'd like to have 2 children.
My heart's desire is to see my daddy.
Every 7 years, Apted checked in with his very diverse group of young people to see how they were doing at age 21, 35, 49. Now, with cameras everywhere and YouTube a click away, you guys probably already do this.
If I was going to make a movie about my childhood, it would be a place that we called Underworld. It's full of trees, and we made bows and arrows and swords out of sticks. It was the older brothers who were the hierarchy. Little brothers were the servants, more or less. And it was a great world for that couple of years.
A new power is rising.
Now that could be the darker underground workshop of the orcs in Lord of the Rings, or the kindler, gentler, the Sandlot. Well, Richard from New York has his own Boys of Summer.
I think the one moment in my childhood that I would like to have a movie made out of was when my friends and I made the All-Star team when we were 12 years old. We almost won the county. We came up one victory short, and we had a great time. It was probably the highlight of my childhood as a 12-year-old.
Important moments in history are like movies for all of us. Most of us still remember the Cuban Missile Crisis. 13 Days, Kevin Costner, Stephen Culp.
Prepare to fire torpedoes.
Prepare to fire torpedoes. Aye, sir.
Prepare to launch ASRock.
Prepare to launch ASRock. Aye, sir.
And a cameo from Laurie Williams in Austin, Texas.
If I was going to make a movie based on a childhood event, it would be based on when I was 7 years old and living in El Paso, Texas. That was the year 1962, the year of the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation.
I was playing outside and heard a loud, loud rumble up in the sky. Apparently, SAC planes had been deployed from Biggs Air Force Base, and as they flew low over my house, these big, gray, abnormally huge planes seemed to my 7-year-old self to blot out the whole sky. It scared me so badly, and I still have nightmares about this to this day.
And finally, everybody's favorite reunion would be great on screen. Listener Judith trying to get a hug here from Colonel Moore, home from the war in We Were Soldiers Once and Young.
Children, your daddy's home!
This is Judy Nathans. I'm calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. When I was about 5 years old, my mother packed my brother and I, who was about seven, into her Henry J. from Newark, New Jersey, and we drove across the country to Kansas, and we met my dad, who had just returned from the Korean War, and he flew a B-29, and we were stationed in a trailer park with all of his crew, and it was quite a summer.
Could be more here. Schürrle once again. That's seven. An utter humiliation for Brazil. Just got worse. Germany in seventh heaven.
A day that will live, as they would say in Portuguese, in infamia. The 7-1 loss for the Germans by the Brazilian national team earlier this week was an echo of history with even more infamy.
I cried. And many Brazilians committed suicide.
Dario Campos remembers the Brazilian loss to Uruguay back in 1950, the only sporting event that can match this week's debacle against Germany. Dario was a student in 1950. He's since acquired a doctorate in economics and philosophy and is a senior economic advisor to the Consul General of Brazil here in New York. He needs all that wisdom to explain to us what's going on in the national consciousness over this humiliation and to prepare for the match on Saturday when Brazil plays Netherlands to determine if they will take third or fourth place in the World Cup tournament. Dario Campos took us back more than 60 years to extract the lessons he sees for Brazil and all of us today.
We all believe that Brazil would win.
Right.
We had an excellent team, the best. But the goals of Uruguay were Schiaffino and Gigia. The goal of Brazil was Friassa. Friassa, the first, beginning of the second half. Schiaffino, 20 minutes later. And Gigia, 10 minutes prior to the end of the game. And one speaker, Ari Barroso, who used to transmit soccer, he said, "From now on, I shall never transmit a soccer game. I shall never go to a stadium to see a soccer game."
That was after the 1950 defeat
exactly.
By Uruguay.
By Uruguay, 2-1.
So much has happened since 1950.
So much has happened. Yeah. And I believe that a very important fact that happened was that until the 50s, Brazil was, I would say, a semi-colony.
Right.
Why? Because we are producers and exporters of raw material. In 1950, President Kubitschek began to industrialize Brazil and call the American and Japanese and German industrialists to invest in Brazil. The key time was 1955, when we began to industrialize. Today, we have a very special situation, the economic situation. I think we are the fifth economy in the world.
Yeah.
We decreased the number of poverty. We increased the middle class. We are improving very much the education in Brazil.
And as we just were mentioning, so much has happened since 1950, since that game against Uruguay.
Oh, yes.
So as you headed into this week, knowing that it was going to be Brazil versus Germany, what were your feelings like?
My feelings, being one
of the few people who have seen both,
yes,
who witnessed
that's right.
both.
That's right. My expectation was that Brazil would win.
Yes.
No doubt about it.
Again.
Or at least equalize and then go to the penalties. Our wish was, expectation was to win. It was really a disappointment.
So as the score became more and more lopsided, how did you feel?
At a certain point, we realized it was impossible to recover when they got the fourth goal.
Yeah.
Until the third goal, I had some hope. There will be a reaction. But when they scored the fourth goal, then I...
What was the mistake of the Brazilian team?
The mistake was, I think we followed the same kind of soccer of the 70s. We have to use the soccer of 2014, of the 21st century, like the Germans, like the Dutch, Costa Ricans.
Mm-hmm.
all players are stars.
Right.
In the 70s, we have 2-3 stars. It no longer works like that.
More team effort. Everyone can be a striker.
Yeah.
The ball can come from anywhere.
Not only a striker. Everyone has to be a striker and a defender.
Right.
Go and come back.
Right.
But in life, we have to extract from the tragedy, from the bad situation, we have to reformulate everything. Brazil shall be Brazil again in soccer.
All right. So heading into this last game, right, first of all, if Argentina beats Germany,
yes,
will that be an additional stake in your heart?
No.
No.
I think the interesting point is that Argentina will represent the soccer of South America.
All right. Look at you. You're on board.
I wish they win.
All right.
But I recognize at the same time it will be very difficult because the Germans are a very superior team. But Argentina plays excellent soccer. They had 3 decisive players like Messi, De Maria, and Higuain, Mascherano in the defense.
Yeah,
the goalkeeper is excellent. So they have possibilities, I think. If they win, I'll tell my friend from Argentina, you saved the honor of South American soccer.
Wow.
I'm going to tell him that.
Look at you. And what about the game against Netherlands?
Maybe Brazil will react. Oh, yeah, maybe. I have the expectation that we shall react and change something already.
Now, react does not necessarily mean win.
Not necessarily. It was very difficult because the Dutch play very well.
Yeah.
But I think that we'll play better than we have done against Germany.
Do you think being the host country, being so much under the international spotlight, put too much pressure on the Brazilian team against Germany?
Interesting story that I have time to say that.
Yeah.
Pelé was 10 years old. His father was crying when Brazil lost. And he said to his father, "Father, don't cry. I shall give you a cup." In 1958, we won in Sweden, and Pelé scored 2 goals. I think that myself, I believe that the majority of the Brazil thinks the same way. We must restructure and modernize soccer. Brazil is already a great nation. And according to the philosopher Hegel, there is permanently in the universe a metamorphosis, a change for the better, qualitative change. Brazil is much better now than in the 50s and shall be much better tomorrow. Inexorably, it will happen.
Quoting the German philosopher Hegel.
Yes.
The Brazilian philosopher Dario Campos. Well, thank you so much for being here.
That's
awesome. And there's a lot of wisdom there.
Well, thank you very much. And we are sad, but at the same time, we must extract to get the lesson that was taught by the Germans. The lesson is nothing is lost. We have to change, to stand up, and be the best again.
Dario Campos experienced the 1950 defeat of Brazil by Uruguay and the even worse loss this week to Germany. He's a senior economic advisor to the Consul General of Brazil and holds a PhD in economics and philosophy. Well, scar tissue or not there, in between watching the final matches in the World Cup this weekend and rooting for Argentina, right? You might be looking for a new book to pick up. Well, the next book in our book club series is Sleep Donation by Karen Russell. It's a sci-fi novella about a dystopian future where America is plagued by an insomnia epidemic. To help us through this haunting read, we joined forces with the book club Babes of Malvern, Pennsylvania. Out of the more than 190 books this book club has read together, Sleep Donation stood out for its provocative questions and abrupt ending.
I got to the end of the page, and then they had a nice biography about the author, and I paged back because I
Louie,
thought,
didn't you say to me, did they send us the second half?
Yeah, she was knocking on a door, and then the book ended. And when I was reading it, if I had been reading on a beach, I would have closed the book and said, ugh, that was ridiculous. But because the next day I went to book club and we discussed it, it was a great book club discussion.
It was.
And you can be a part of that great book club discussion on Sleep Donation next week. If you want to participate in the Takeaway Book Club, text the word book club to 69866. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to share your comments and questions about the book. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Have a great weekend. Enjoy the weekender on The Takeaway.